G'day, policy heads. It's been too long since the last time we did this podcast. And
way too long.
Yeah, pardon us for our long hibernation. But we are back, which is exciting. We are back on episode 9 today. We will be talking about human rights and criminal justice policy. Today is our coffee session, which means we will be having casual discussions. But it's quite a special coffee session because we have our fellow policy head with us today, which is Damien Narayan.
Hey, how are you going?
Good, how are you?
Yeah, good. You know, just before we get started, I just wanted to start by acknowledging the traditional owners and custodians of the lands that we're respectively dialing in from, and pay my respects to any Aboriginal elders, past, present, and emerging. And I also just wanted to start off with a quick disclaimer that any of the views and opinions that I'm going to be presenting today is that of my own and does not reflect that of my employer or the broader Victorian government. So with that out of the way, I'll just hand back to you.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much for coming on the actual podcast today with us, Damien, because Damien's one of our fellow students at the University of Melbourne, which we've happily been engaging with over the past couple of years as we've studied together. So first off, I just wanted to kind of get a sense of where we are all at the moment, especially with the coming down of stage 4 restrictions in Victoria at the moment, which has kind of been unprecedented. We didn't really want to see this coming, but we're here, unfortunately. So Sheila, what have you been up to in the past couple of weeks?
Where do I even start? There's a lot of things going on, but at the same time, it's like time just flies. Yeah, I've been just working, studying, doing bits of here and there, some projects. But yeah, it's been quite boring, to be honest, like not being able to socialize with people or not being able to do this podcast, which has made my life a lot less fun. How are you guys?
Oh, well, I'm personally having also a quasi-weird time going on because I've just been really getting into the books, really reading a lot at the moment. I've ordered about 10 books over the past 3 weeks at this point, so
that's
I'm really
the way
just,
you do it.
I know, I've just been like beating those out of the way, and the reason why I kind of went off into a little bit of a rabbit hole was because I really got into an economic subject along which I was studying with Damien, so him and I have probably got a little bit of post-traumatic stress from that, I can definitely say that for sure.
And a bit of Stockholm syndrome.
Yeah, a little bit. It's just like everything that I think about now is just, once again, pure economics. Like you thought you knew everything and then you just get right into it and it's just, it's all there. But apart from that, I've also just been doing my casual politicking, like watching the Northern Territory election, which is coming up this month, which home territory I'm very excited about. So we'll have to see how the Territorial Labor government goes with retaining its hold on power, if it can with the whole COVID, but they're doing quite better than we are down here. So I'll have to see how that goes. But what about you, Damien? What have you been up to?
Well, actually not too much because I ended up right before we went into lockdown, I was assisting with one of the COVID testing sites, and then I got home, bent forward and tore a spinal ligament somehow. So been out of action for the last few weeks, but definitely come back in at full force. I'm studying full time and definitely quite a lot going on at the Department of Health and Human Services. So we're just really focusing in on trying to, you know, keep the momentum and not really get too dampened down in terms of morale and everything else that's coming with the stage 4 restrictions. But yeah, pushing through.
Well, I hope your ligament is doing much better now. Why don't you let us know what you do, what professional experiences, and where are you working at the moment, and what are you doing in that role?
So I'm a senior policy officer with the Department of Health and Human Services. So that's the Victorian State Department for service provision to vulnerable Victorians. So it includes a series of service offers, including housing, child protection, out-of-home care, as well as disability services. So with the National Disability Insurance Scheme, quite a lot of the disability services that used to be provided by the state have now transitioned across to the Commonwealth. But there's a small residual function which we call the Forensic Disability Program. So that refers to another series of service offers to people with cognitive impairment who exhibit high-risk behaviours of concern or high-risk offending behaviours. So we've got a series of case coordination services, intake services, clinical services, and secure services. And my team's job is to look after the policy and strategy for those services. So a lot of that is around policy design to figure out an appropriate balance between, you know, providing a human services response, that is, that where a key pillar is safeguarding the rights of the person with disability, as well as working on that community safety side of things. So it's definitely quite a delicate balance.
What do you think you find most interesting lately that you've been thinking about in terms of your professional experiences? Or what sort of issues that you think would be very interesting for us to discuss today?
Well, there's definitely been quite a lot to think about with, you know, COVID happening. One of the more interesting things that we've come across is how do you provide services whilst not actually being face-to-face with the person who is receiving services. So that refers to a lot of our, that applies to a lot of the services that we provide. But within the residential context, we have both secure units, which people can be directed by the courts to reside there to receive treatment. And we also have some non-secure community residential services. So one of the interesting things about that is because there's still that face-to-face service provision, there's obviously these new restrictions around wearing face masks. And often a lot of the clients we provide services to are hearing impaired or deaf. So wearing a face mask can raise a lot of concerns around accessibility. But yeah, so that's probably the primary thing we're thinking about right now with COVID. And then we're also thinking about a lot of these other ways that we can integrate with the new Commonwealth scheme. So through the NDIS, there's a lot happening at the Commonwealth space, in addition to our forensic space. And how do we find a way to really integrate the two pieces of legislation? But in terms of the second part of your question, Sheila, about what's interesting to talk about today, I think we've got a really interesting topic on human rights in the criminal justice space. And I think there's a lot to talk about there. Specifically in my space, one thing we come across a lot is a person with disability, mainly cognitive impairment, a lot of the time exhibit what's called behaviours of concern, where, you know, we all have different wants and needs and desires in life. And people like you and I, if we feel really isolated or we want something, you know, we feel angry or something like that, we can just pick up the phone, talk to a friend, have a vent. Whereas a lot of the people we provide services to might not necessarily have that in their toolbox. And instead, they might resort to punching a hole in the wall, or they might push a service provider or a staff member away from them. So it gets to this point where there's an acknowledgement that that person is attempting to convey something. They're trying to communicate with you because they don't have any more pro-social skills available to them at the time. But that also comes with a recognition that they are potentially posing a risk to community safety. So that leaves us with this really complicated debate as to how do we actually deal with that.
Absolutely. What are the considerations that you think we can take a step forward into when thinking about that?
I think the way that we go about that is first identifying the legislative framework. So we can look at, from the human rights perspective, we've got various pieces of legislation. So we've got the Victorian Charter of Rights and Responsibilities Act, in addition to the Equal Opportunities Act, and a series of other international law, you know, created by the United Nations. And all of these things create the considerations that public institutions must make when providing services. On the other hand, we do have legislation and policy in place where we are required to do something. For instance, if the courts order a person to reside in one of our secure facilities, we will have to restrict that person's right to movement, their freedom of movement, and a series of other rights and responsibilities that should protect that person. So there's not too much wiggle room there, but I suppose the first step here is being aware of the various rights and responsibilities that are being potentially limited in order to balance that with, you know, those greater principles of community safety and keeping all of those things in mind. So I would say the first step is just awareness of where we're at.
Thanks for that. So talking about criminal justice and human rights, I think what our listeners would very, very, very interested to know about is, of course, the Black Lives Matter movement. You know, the solutions that they proposed and problem framings that they addressed to the public as well. What are your general thoughts or general opinions on that?
Look, I won't claim to be an expert in this space. It's definitely a really complicated, really tricky space, policy space to navigate, where I think we, you know, need the voice of experience to be at the forefront of this discussion. That said, I think there's a lot of really interesting phrases being thrown around. One thing Jared and I were talking about recently was this idea of defunding the police. I think it's a really interesting sentiment that's been brought up quite a lot. And I think, you know, historically, I don't know that many people would have necessarily jumped on board with the idea, given that they might feel that there's this fear associated with moving towards this anarchist society. But I think it's a really interesting sentiment to raise, because I do feel that in some ways there is almost an over-reliance on the police in particular, an over-reliance on a police response to particular problems and issues within society. For instance, there's often police involvement when dealing with homelessness, with dealing with people with disability in the community, especially when there's behaviours of concern involved. Also when there's, you know, there might need to be a community engagement function that needs to be put in place, and we often resort to another response. So I think there's, you know, the way that we deal with that, I think there's various pathways we can go down. In Victoria, there's obviously, in Victoria Police, we've got the Priority Communities Division that have a great program around community engagement, safeguarding rights of people of marginalised communities, and a whole suite of these strategies that we have in place. I don't know of the if they've been evaluated or what the specific success rate of these strategies are, but I'm wondering if, you know, taking these things to the US model, where we're seeing, you know, the concentration of these conversations, I'm wondering if, you know, the current funding that's put towards community safety can also be explored to be invested into community engagement strategies, other forms of education, and other responses that might potentially be more well-equipped to deal with social problems in society.
Mm. Yeah, I'll have to agree with Damien on that statement, because when we were talking about this prior, we have to remember that the American and the Australian context are quite different in some respects of defunding the police. So we're looking at how in the American contexts, their police departments aren't as centralised as ours are in Australia. So there's the Victoria Police, where in the United States, there'll be county police stations. So what we've got to really talk about in Australia, and this is exactly what Damien was touching on, we need to reconsider the priorities. So do we want more police in prisons at the cost of social housing, mental health services and domestic violence and family support programs? So it's about where we should put the money and how we can invest it in order to reduce crimes in other way, rather than, say, investing more in the militarization of police. Now, that's a very broad statement for me to say militarization of the police, but that's something that we need to be well aware of as well.
No, some great points there. And it's interesting to see. I came from a forum a few months ago, actually, well before a few months ago because of COVID. It would have been about late last year, probably, now that I think about it, where we were talking about a lot of the justice reinvestment work that's happening in the US and a focus on, you know, an acknowledgement of the incredibly high incarceration rates, not that Australia can talk, but in the US, and finding ways to really ameliorate that. And I think that it's a really great point that you raise around looking back to our priorities, because I think that if we were to specifically, you know, really bolster our response, potentially mental health, for instance, I think it could be, you know, there's the benefits for people who require that response. But in addition, it might potentially be quite a dangerous situation to put a police officer in America who has no mental health training in a situation with a person with mental health support needs. So it's, I think there's across the board some really positive gains that can be made from a more holistic support model that complements that community safety response.
Although from a bird's eye view, I think observing what's been happening and how much distrust society has had towards the system itself, because a lot of the damages that the system has done, although, you know, like I acknowledge the merits as well, but how can the government reconvince that it is actually worth it to invest into that?
Oh, look, it's a really good question. And I feel like there is no straightforward, simple solution. It's going to be something that is going to take quite literally decades of work. Like when we talk about institutionalized racism and heaps, you know, prejudice in so many different streams of life that have really been incorporated into kind of the bricks and mortar of the system, it, you know, is not something that can really be solved with like a quick package of strategies. I feel like a, you know, it needs to have a multi-pronged approach. I think that creating, you know, sticking on the matter of police, I think we need to have a police force that is representative of the community that they serve. So making sure that we don't have that really clear, you know, that the model where a lot of the people, that gap between police officers and working in a community where people in that community have no sense of relationship or sense of closeness with the person who is there. For instance, I think, you know, whether it's a quota mechanism or whatever the process is, finding a way to provide mentorship or strategies to get people from marginalized communities into the police force. In addition, I think there's a really, really key piece of work in the US around self-reflection, because I'm sure a lot of the people who are potentially some of the people in the police force in the US who are complicit with a lot of the stuff that we're talking about here, they may not necessarily realize that they have this level of racism that's curbing the way that they think and steering the way that they behave. So I think in order to flag to that person, hey, you actually need to start changing the way that you do things. The way that you are doing things currently is not appropriate just because it's all you know and everyone else around you is doing the same things. There needs to be something around self-reflection to identify those really key indicators. And then just being accountable for the decisions you make and really consistently over years, so that people, you know, can see that they're not seeing these instances of lives being lost without any necessary ramifications that are commensurate in the level of severity. And I think once we've got a lot of those things happening, more transparency, we potentially might see some of that trust being rebuilt.
So the thing that I would like to touch on as well is that Damien's interest in justice policy has very much well and clicked with my interest in Indigenous rights and Indigenous policy within Australia. And especially, as I said before, I've been reading and following a lot about the Northern Territory election. So a systemic problem in the Northern Territory we have at the problem is the high rates of incarceration of Indigenous youth, which for the past 3 weeks have been, or and longer than that, probably months, has been fully Indigenous. Before we go into the subject, I need to say that I hold no Indigenous heritage, but I'm speaking from a point of view of research, and that later down the line I would like to bring in someone to discuss the Indigenous side of this in a future episode. But just for now, I think it would be good to discuss what we might need to see in the justice system in order to prevent this from happening, And that is going back to the statement that I made before, is that we need to think about in Australia where we need to reinvest the funding to services that can stop this from happening in the first place. And we find at the Northern Territory that they've basically done snapback between harsher penalties back to providing services in order to cut down on Indigenous incarceration rates. So from your point of view, Damien, what do you believe that the Northern Territory government could do in terms of services or maybe adjusting their incarceration system that could help us see a decline of Indigenous youth being incarcerated?
Really great question there. I feel like one of the key things that we need to keep in mind is, you know, we talk a lot about what can government do, but it's almost about what can government facilitate, because a lot of this isn't going to be direct action from government. It's going to be more around allowing communities to really act in accordance with, you know, embodying that sense of self-determination. So I think whatever, you know, that looks like in those communities, definitely, you know, I've got quite limited exposure to that space. I think that though some of the really, you know, straightforward things that we can start to think about is, again, this idea about reflecting, self-reflection, about understanding how do you alter service provision when you are working with a person who, you know, might be from these communities. There's a lot of cultural kind of nuances that need to be accounted for that I don't think necessarily are there. And moving just from that really small kind of quite contained issues around just direct service provision, I think there's a really key piece again about looking at, you know, the police force. What is the decision-making structure that, you know, from the start of a person's contact with the criminal justice system, what is every decision that's being made that leads to a person becoming, an Aboriginal person becoming incarcerated? What were the opportunities for cautioning? What were the opportunities for a referral into a more holistic support service? What were the decisions that were made, and how are they reviewed? How are they evaluated to ensure that these, you know, that prison for especially a young person from an Aboriginal community, that prison and incarceration is the very, very last resort. What has been done to achieve that? I don't know what their system looks like. We've definitely got a lot of resources channeled in Victoria into diversion, into keeping young people out of prison, because we've seen in the literature, you know, the second you put someone into prison, you've just incredibly exponentially increased their risk of staying in that prison, in that environment, and that when they come out, it's instantly that revolving door. So I think it's all about early prevention, self-determination, and finding ways so that we can really break the cycle before they even hit it, before they even touch the system.
And I'll definitely have to agree with what you've just said there, Damien. I think you've just touched on everything that I would have to say as well, especially with the upcoming election. I've been looking at what can they do in order to help the Indigenous youth before they've even entered the system, and how we can actually prevent these things from happening, providing these services that these communities ultimately need in order to be self-determinant and self-flourishing. And that's something that government doesn't seem to understand at this point, especially with, ironically, we've gone into a curfew here in Melbourne. A curfew has been announced and we've been put in operation, when as there has been a string of quote-unquote youth crime in our Springs and Northern Territory, where one of the campaign pledges of the Territory Alliance Party, now this is just a specific policy, one of their campaign pledges within 100 days is to institute a curfew after 10 o'clock for under 16-year-olds to be off the street. Now, do you believe that that could be a certain way of going about things, or do you think that's absolutely abhorrent?
Oh, look, I think we need to be really careful when we're talking about a policy that only applies to a very small group of people, especially in this situation. There's, you know, labelling theory has a really strong evidence basis behind it. There was a study done, I think it was Somerville Campbell or something like that, where they basically had identified this is a really rudimentary criminological study. They identified a series of risk factors that they had found in people that made them more likely to become involved in the criminal justice system later in life. And what they found was low socioeconomic status, mental health issues, struggling academically, and a suite of other issues. And what they did was they found in a school, they found a lot of young people who had those same traits. And in an effort to prevent that group from, you know, getting in contact with the criminal justice system, they found ways to counteract it. So if they were struggling academically, they would get a mentor. There was lots of scholarships to counteract the low SES. There was a lot of support to go on school trips, do sports, and do everything that they felt was going to find a way to get these young people to, you know, counteract those risk factors. And what they found was when they compared it to their control study, they had exponentially increased the risk of this group offending. There was a higher risk of suicide. There was a higher risk of self-harm, of contact with the justice system, because what they had done was just completely stigmatize this group of people who were already expected to offend. It was flagging to them, we think you're going to do something really bad. That's the type of people we think you are, to a very, you know, impressionable youth, and basically steering them down a really negative path. So I think talking about that strategy that you just mentioned, in terms of it's from an evidence basis, will it be effective? I don't think so. And that's not even, you know, touching the can of worms that happens when we talk about the human rights of these people. I think it's definitely not something that I would be too keen to explore further.
Well, thank you so much for answering my question there. I appreciate that.
I was thinking about the use of AI for policing.
Oh, yeah.
And when we talk about racism in criminal justice system, some people would argue based on like human bias. Like when we talk about the stop and frisk policy, we could argue that, oh, it's just the human bias. It's not the systemic bias. But when we talk about the use of AI in justice system, and because AI is like such a black box, you can't really pinpoint how they make decisions, and it creates another ambiguity in like transparency and accountability as well.
I'm not too sure where we're at in Australia in the use of AI in the criminal justice system, but I think you hit the nail on the head when you're talking about what are the risks here. Because just putting the idea of transparency and accountability to the side, there's a very specific risk that I think about when we talk about racism, for instance, and stigmatizing particular groups. Because, you know, an algorithm will, you know, that what we were talking about earlier in terms of self-reflection, trying to cultivate a sense of self-reflection into an algorithm, you know, we haven't even fully understood how to do that ourselves. It's such a human, you know, response, and trying to put that into a system and getting a system to be able to do that, it's almost as if, you know, what does that look like? Is that just increasing the risk margin? You know, in terms of a computer, how do we get those really humanistic responses in there to make sure that we're, you know, not accidentally veering towards this really Orwellian society? There's definitely a trade-off. We can talk about the efficiency gains, but at what point do we stop and say, you know, efficiency might not necessarily be worth the potential social costs to society that we might be, you know, accidentally incurring?
Yeah, absolutely. I absolutely agree with you. Someone actually messaged me and asking about the Raise the Age movement, like about like how in Australia children at the age of 10 can be arrested.
That it's actually the age of 12.
Age of 12, that's what I meant. I think a lot of the movements, they want to raise the age to 14.
Yeah, well, I think Jared probably will have a lot to say about this, so I'll hand over to him in a moment. But I think there's a lot of considerations that need to be made. You know, the concept of, you know, having an age of where there is no criminal responsibility is based on that concept of Jolly Incapax, where a young person doesn't necessarily have a lot of those cognitive faculties that are required to understand crime, to understand the ramifications of their actions, to understand the pain that they might have been inflicting, or whatever those characteristics are. So I think, you know, If we go about raising the age, which I personally think there, you know, is a very strong argument for that, that we need to be cognizant of where is this offending coming from? Is it learned behavior? There's a lot of, you know, social learning theories of crime where exposure to parents, for instance, victimization of the crime itself. There's, you know, a series of, you know, closeness with antisocial, you know, associates might lead to the offending itself. It might be due to disability or other forms of support needs that manifest in a way that breach a law. So I think, you know, raising the age in itself, I think, you know, might be fraught. We need to think about what are the referral pathways that accompany somebody hitting the criminal justice system. There is a, you know, there's a very clear acknowledgement this person is not criminally responsible, but there needs to be a very strong social human services response to think, you know, it's not just about let's delay this a few more years and that person will come into contact with the justice system then. Let's really use this as an opportunity to divert this person.
And Sheila, we'll have to cut this out. It is 10, like people are able to be picked up at 10, but it kind of varies, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think based on my readings, it's 10, but I'm not really sure like how. Okay, yeah, go on.
Yeah, I did actually study the raise the age issue at the start of this year in relation to my policy work on and research on Indigenous youth incarceration rates in the Northern Territory. So I looked at it through the lens of the Amnesty International, where between 2018 2019, over 8,000 children aged between 10 to 13 were put through the criminal justice system, and under about 600 of those were in detention at the age of 14. So I'm really going to have to agree with a lot of what Damien said, actually. I can't really add much to it, because we really need to understand the socioeconomic factors as well, and the reasons why they're there in the first place, and why the cycle's not being able to be broken, A, from the start or once they've left. So, you know, and between that time, which I said before with 2018, 2019, 64% or more of those children were Indigenous and they were in prison. And children aren't supposed to be in prison and behind bars. They're supposed to be in their communities, enjoying climbing trees and going to community swimming pools and learning culture and being mentored. And these services such as psychology and family support, mentoring, counselling and healthcare and other services just aren't being provided in a specific way. So personally, raise the age to me as well, it needs to be done. It needs to be raised to the 14, which Amnesty International has advocated for, and that we need to look at not putting Indigenous children or young children for that matter behind bars, and that we need to look to more government funded Indigenous led solutions and community programs, especially in the Northern Territory. So that's kind of where I've come from on that. But once again, I'm looking to look at this issue in a couple of weeks especially with an Indigenous perspective on it, because I think that's very, very important to look at as well.
Thanks for that, Jared. I might just snatch the mic if that's okay and ask you guys a question. So obviously this podcast is about kind of the interface and its relationship between policy and politics. I think criminal justice policies can become very divisive, and definitely is a really key strategy in, you know, trying to admonish a particular party in their stance on criminal justice. Do you guys have a view on what potential strategies might be put in place to make us rely more so on evidence-based practice as opposed to strategies that are going to lead to more of a perceived sense of safety and action, but not necessarily lead to any results?
Look, I might go first.
Okay.
I'm not a very big hard law and order fan. I find that shock and awe policies, which are sometimes utilized by certain criminal justice systems, isn't the best way of going about things. Personally, evidence-based policy is very, very important, and especially where I come from, looking at what we've been talking about before, is that we need to look at the social economic factors that surround the crime rates that are going on.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that we need to look at the mental well-being, the social economic factors that people are being put through? Is there a large amount of substance abuse due to X, Y, and Z? Is there a large, like, drug education is much more important and economically better than and then drug punishment?
Yes.
It's well studied. And what we need to look at is how we can look at evidence and then work with that evidence to create policy to make people's lives better from there on. Shock and awe and locking someone up and direct punishment over rehabilitation or education personally doesn't work for me. That kind of comes from a historical, you know, precedent of me looking at the 1960s Nixon election, where he was the law and order candidate. And we kind of see it today with a certain Republican in the White House at the moment, the law and order candidate, you know, shock and awe, you know, and I personally have seen it in the Northern Territory, shock and awe, pickup laws. We've seen it in New York, stop and frisk. It's just not working. It's not appropriate. And it divides more than it conquers, if that makes sense. Evidence-based in looking at social economic factors and now you can make people self-sufficient and make them avoid the cycle in the long run is much better in my personal opinion.
I agree with you. You know, when we talk about like criminal justice, I think what makes it very hard not to look at the issue in a very politicized kind of way is that when we talk about human rights, there's a lot of perspectives that come into it. It's not like when we talk about COVID-19 or climate change, even the concept of fairness itself is like completely nuanced. There's no one way to implement fairness. And I think that's when politicization come in, because there's a lot of contesting ideologies. And I think that's okay too. That's how we solve the policy to make it better. But I agree with Jared completely in that sense as well.
Yeah. And with Sheila on human rights, I think I was reading the other day, And it really struck me that human rights has really only been a major force on the global stage for the past century. After one of the largest wars we've ever had and the atrocities that we saw out of that, did we really take human rights seriously with the United Nations Human Rights Charter? We've always, you know, and especially with the relating to the old Declaration of Independence and all men being equal, that we thought that, you know, that was pinnacle, but it's grown over since then. So I would have to agree with Sheila as well. And that's what we try and do on this podcast. We try and kind of take the politics away from things and we try and put the policy in front. But sometimes, you know, ideologies do get in the way.
I feel like if there was a way that we could, you know, cultivate society to this point where, you know, you hear about like stop and frisk or curfews and things like that, and just the vast majority of people in society just go, why on earth would you think that works? Or why would you even bother trying to do that to like kids or whoever else? Like, I feel like if we can ever get to a point where society's like that, where you know, you hear those things without an evidence basis and you just, and there's not that necessary support for it, I feel like that would be a way, but looks like we might potentially be a little way away from there. But I think we'll slowly, you know, creep towards that ideal.
But also, I think when we started this podcast, I didn't think we actually intentionally want to take away all the politics from it. It's more of like discussing it from the three-dimensional point of view. Like politics, do you play a role in like how the policy is being made? But we don't want to attach ourselves into the political ideology when we discuss about it. So, yeah. And it's, I think that's what makes it important when we discuss about things, because that's how we get into a fruitful conversation.
Well, thank you so much, Damien, for coming on the show. It's been fantastic and an absolute delight to have you and see your thoughts and your perspectives, especially coming from the senior policy officer point of view and working within government. So it's great to have that experience in the actual, well, I won't say studio, but you know, the dial-in room.
The virtual studio.
Yeah,
no, so thank you so much. Thank you for inviting me. It was great.
It's great having you.
Yeah. And it's just been great to get back into the conversation and the swing of things. And we'll be bringing you back episodes in the next coming weeks and from a range of topics. So Sheila, have you got an idea of what we're going to be talking about next?
Yeah. So this week we had Damien. But we're also having a wonderful scholar that would help us discuss about COVID-19 and its impact for women, especially motherhood. Yeah, which will be exciting. And we also want to talk about the 2020 the US election next week, hopefully, or not the following week. It will be, that will be spicy.
That's going to get very, very spicy. All right. Well, thanks everyone for chucking us a listen. It's great to be back, and we'll keep you updated with more podcasts from here on out. So welcome back to season 2 with Politics Versus Policy and Sheila and Jared. Woo! So once again, thank you, Damien, for coming on. It's been fantastic to have you. And chuck us a listen on anywhere where you can find your local podcast. You know where I mean. I'm not going to tell you to subscribe like I usually do. Anyway, I'll catch you all later. Bye.
Bye.
Bye.